You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 330. In Stockton, California, every resident is to be given $500 a month with no strings attached. Would a basic income policy work in the UK? The ups and downs of footballers on social media. And from the Beatles to public service broadcasting, the challenges of bringing complex recorded material to the live environment. It's all coming up after the Lightning Seeds and the Life of Riley.
I do rather like that. It's rather a cheery tune. I can't believe how old it is. It is 25 years old. Wow. This year, having been first released on the 2nd of March 1992. It got to number 28 on the UK singles chart, but it later gained popularity because they used to use it for goal of the month or match of the day, apparently. And so it's still sort of sung as a result of that. Also a cover of it by a chap called Willie Dowling, who goes by the name Jack Dorfour, was used as the theme to the rather a badly received BBC TV sitcom Life of Riley, which starred Caroline Quentin in 2009 and is often cited in death knell of the sitcom type pieces, which is never a good sign, is it? But anyway, I do think that the Lightning Seeds are Ian Broody is a gifted writer of pop, I think, and that's a fine example.
It's fascinating, really, how some artists they hit that hot streak and achieve a string of hits. I think Ian Broady's run of hit singles, kind of late 80s to late 90s, and just one hit after another. It's amazing how just some people just have that knack. They hit the kind of I was going to say zeitgeist. I hate that word of the way of that time, and then just as quickly the hits stop coming.
Although he has achieved some kind of note as a producer in later years as well. Apparently, that's his kind of what he's sort of doing now. But no, you're right. like there was I got the Best of the Lightning Seeds on. I think there's more than one, but I got the original one on tape in the late 90s, I think. It smacked of a kind of a we need one more album to complete this record type thing. I don't know if that was true or not, but yeah, I got it for Christmas when I was about 14 or 15. I've still got it somewhere. And I still play it. It's you know, like you say, a real streak of kind of amazing singles on it. I mean, you know, their debut hit was with Pure, which is such a, you know, such a wonderful sort of pop tune, and that was their first one. And they, you know, they've had that, he had a complete run of those singles, like you say. So I do think they're, I don't know why it is, they've never been quote unquote cool, have they?
That's
really
very true. Yeah of course, Life of Riley, named after his son Riley, and looking at, you were saying how long ago that was released, his then baby Riley is now the guitarist in his band, so much time has
time,
moved on.
Time, life comes at you fast, and time makes fools of us all.
Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 330. I'm Terence Stackham, and not only living the life of Riley, but also La Vida Loca and living the high life, it's Juliet Harris.
I know, I have so much going on at any given moment. It's enough to make you want to change out of your pyjamas into day clothes. Hello, everyone.
Jules, one of the... And there are several factors that divide the nation, is that at the two ends, there are those who see all job seekers and those unable to work as sponges and a drain upon society, and at the other extreme, that those who believe that benefits are kept deliberately low to humiliate people, keep them in their place. But what if all the usual dogma and accepted views were thrown out the window and both of those concepts were put aside, and literally every resident was given, just simply given, a standard amount of money every month with no strings attached, no means test. Everyone simply receives a set amount. This is gaining some traction around the world. The latest example is Stockton, a city in California, where quite simply...
Not to be confused with Stockton-on-Tees, of course.
No, unlikely at the moment to be introduced there. In 2018, in Stockton, California, they plan to give a sample of residents, as an experiment, $500 a month, no strings. Now, you know, Jules, I'm thinking, is this misplaced idealism, or could it work, and could it work in the UK?
Well, and this is it, isn't it, really? It's an enormous concept, and it seems like the more you dig into it, the more that there is that you need to kind of think about. So it's known, sort of a catch-all term, as universal basic income, sorry, or UBI. So I've been reading into this, and it's one of those things, like I say, the more I read, the more that I kind of think, oh, what about this and what about that? There was a referendum, actually, on this in Switzerland, to see whether or not people wanted it introduced, and it was defeated heavily. It was 76.9% voted against basic income. And like you say, there is a negative argument against it, the idea of the something for nothing culture, and the idea that, you know, why should you be paid just as a matter of course. And I suppose, really, if you want to kind of go into what universal basic income means, the real root of it goes to work and how we value work, and what value we place upon work in society, and how we build society around work. Because by introducing universal basic income, what you're effectively saying is one doesn't have to work in order to be able to live. And obviously, I'm surprised that the Scandinavian countries haven't introduced it yet, because the Scandinavian thinking, this is very broad brush, but I think you can generally say that the Scandinavians have an attitude where the sort of the old work to live rather than live to work kind of idea. So in terms of sort of paying people not to do anything, if you say, or rather paying people a basic sum to live on, I suppose the practicalities of it are, you know, what is defined as a basic need? Is it food? Is it housing? To what extent do you cap those basic needs? And actually, the other thing for me that universal basic income is sort of addressing is the idea of structural inequality in society. And your point that you made about how people at the top think that, you know, all benefits claiming scum, and people at the bottom think, you know, oh, we're deliberately being pushed down. What I suppose... I think that work and structural inequalities is how we need to look at this, because there's a new story in the news every day, isn't there, about the idea that, you know, we've got the stuff that's going on with Oxbridge and how David Lammy is saying that, you know, there are, last year apparently they took more applicants from one individual school, i.e. Eton, than from people on free school meals across the whole country. So there are sort of structural inequalities going on there. There were also the Weinstein stuff that's been coming out and which has started, and I'm glad it has, a broader conversation about how we treat women across society and how we value, or rather don't value, women across society. Women are still paid on average 14% less than men doing the same jobs. So in a way, would universal basic income do something to address that? But I have a slight problem with universal basic income not because I necessarily have a problem with people being given benefits, although I do think that benefits should be reserved for the most vulnerable members of our society. I think that's what I hate the term welfare. I prefer the term social security, because I do believe that everyone has the right to feel socially secure. And there are some people, perhaps not as many as would want to claim benefit, but there are some people who genuinely cannot work or cannot work to a full extent. I think, being a Labour supporter, that the job of a Labour government is to support as many people into work as possible, whilst I don't think it's wrong that there should be some assessment of the benefit system, although the ATOS design disaster is really not, you know, there's been some real incidents of cruelty there, which I think are shameful. But the Labour Party, I think, was really important, and we'll talk about South Wales coal mining later on. But the idea that the Industrial Revolution, you know, revolutionised the idea that many, many, many working people then were able to go out to work and to earn money for working. And I think there is a real dignity in work. I think that for someone that was unemployed for a little while, it is amazing, once you take that away, how you have this kind of sense of purpose that's built up in work, and the idea of producing and being a member of society that participates. And I am concerned a bit, not from the kind of blaggerama perspective, but from the idea that if you take that away from people, the idealistic sort of nature behind it is that, oh, well, it then frees you up to do creative things with your time, or other things with your time that are not necessarily focused around work, and that's how you can then contribute to society. And I'm still a slight, you know, I'm not quite as wildly communist as I might have been in my youth, but, you know, there is still a part of me that, you know, views work as a bit of a rat race, particularly as there is such structural inequality in society that at the moment I can see why the idea of a universal basic income appeals to some people, because it feels like when you get new sets of financial sector results, there are a few people at the top sharing a lot of the wealth, this 1% and the 99% idea, and you would be redistributing that wealth. You then get stuck into what is it that you're redistributing, and this is where UBI is really radical, because the most widespread idea of it that you know, you get economists sort of chatting about, is the idea that you are redistributing income from profits of publicly owned enterprises. So it's often called a social dividend or a citizen's dividend. So in a way, you're moving towards market socialism. So in terms of whether or not it will come in Britain, you are having to basically completely restructure the way that we make money in Britain and who benefits from Britain. So I suppose, to summarise, and I'm sorry, that is long-winded, but there is a lot going on with it. I suppose I want to see the structural inequality of Britain and the world, and particularly the workplace, addressed. I want there to be a situation whereby people, you know, whereby we all, I think if we all earn, you know, out similarly, and I think if there wasn't such structural inequality, then maybe there wouldn't be the need for universal basic income. I think the nearest thing we've had to it in this country was the Labour government of 1997-2010 introduced working tax credits and the minimum wage. And now, of course, there is an argument against those sort of things, and that you're saying, are you pushing wages down? Are you sort of, are you effectively, working tax credits, what you're doing is you're supplementing people's low-paid income with enough for them to be able to live effectively. And in a way, it's a better system than just benefit, because what you're doing is you're rewarding people for going out to work, but at the same time you are acknowledging the fact that work is not paid well enough, that you know, that you have got people that run companies sort of creaming off the profits and not paying people properly. And does that stop that from changing? I don't know. But working tax credits, I think, were an interesting idea in that respect. And I wonder if something like that might be a certainly more nuanced way of dealing with it. Because my final point, and I promise I will stop talking in a minute. My final point is there's similar-ish sort of ideas. There's a system here in Britain at the moment, which the Conservative government is sort of leading, called universal credit. And this is the idea that there are all sorts of different benefits you can claim in Britain. So you can claim incapacity benefit if you're not well enough to work. You can claim, you know, sort of the standard job seeker's allowance, or the DOL, as we would have called it back in the day. There's all sorts of different
housing
types.
Benefit, council
yeah,
tax
absolutely,
benefit.
Yeah, all sorts of things. And the idea is that there's going to be this new system whereby, and this has been in the making for years, to the point where when I went to Labour Party conference 2012, people were worried about it at that point. That's how long this has been going on. And the idea is that you roll all those benefits up into a single benefit that people then claim. It's been piloted in various places to mixed levels of success. Where it has been successful is where the people that they've trialled it on have been single men, basically young single men, who are the least complicated of cases. Where universal credit, I suppose in theory it might be a good idea because you're trying to simplify the system by just giving people one payment of benefit. But the difficulty is that you're assuming that everybody that claims benefits, it leads a normal, simple, orderly life and has, you know, the circumstances which allow them to be able to take responsible decisions as to how to spend all that money. It doesn't deal well with complicated cases at all. And also, and I think Helen Lewis in the New States has said this, are there any words that strike fear in the heart like government-backed IT projects? No, I don't think there are. So when it comes to universal basic income, how are you going to administer that system? Same way as universal credit. How are you going to give the money to people? To what extent are you going to support people, vulnerable people that might not be very good at managing that? And also, is your IT up to scratch? Because every single bloody system that's ever come into place has really, you know, in Britain is always beset by IT difficulties. So in terms of Britain, the practicalities of it worry me, as well as whether or not we are leaving behind the dignity of work because we can't be bothered to address structural inequality.
I first became aware of these basic income initiatives about 18 months ago, and I read about a scheme in Ontario, Canada, which also aimed at giving a monthly income just enough to cover essential bills, and it gave the money to everyone without proving they were actively seeking work. Simply, again, no strings. But ever since then, it's struck me ever more so that with the rise and unstoppable rise of artificial intelligence, and with that, robots, mechanisation, drone deliveries, driverless cars, and so on. We're just on the verge of that. I mean, we're just dipping our toe in the water. The idea that a basic income removes the stigma of means-tested welfare systems, and it also, with that basic income guaranteed, it means that work always pays and encourages people to take a chance. And I'm thinking particularly in setting up new businesses or trying self-employment. If you've got that guaranteed basic income no matter what, then you can afford to take a chance with self-employment or setting up a business. But I think the most telling reason of all, and I think this is the most fascinating and almost what an indictment of the bureaucracy of our society, is that it actually, anybody at home thinking, oh yeah, we're just throwing money at people, but it actually saves the public purse money, because it's easier on the public purse. All the bureaucracy of means testing benefits is removed.
Yeah.
And with that, so the cost to the public of that bureaucracy is removed, and extraordinarily, every report on basic income says simply giving out this money is actually the cheaper option than running a benefits system like the one we have in this country.
It's interesting, really interesting.
Of course, the next step we would consider after the basic income is simply to give people homes. But I think we've talked enough on this subject.
Although,
for another day.
Just to go back on that point briefly about housing, and this is where I think, particularly introducing it in Britain, you might come against the biggest kind of difficulty is when you talk about covering basic needs. Mm. If it is designed to cover housing costs, so rent, say, or mortgage payment, if you're trying to introduce housing as a basic need, which I very strongly believe that it is, then the housing market in Britain and housing costs vary wildly from area to area, and particularly London. And we've talked on the podcast before, I think, about the cost of living in London and how I've got a friend that rents a room in Zone 3, and that is more expensive than the mortgage on my two-bedroom flat in Hastings. And you've got all sorts of examples of that. And this is why I'm saying, when it comes to structural inequality, that I think that demonstrates that I wonder to what extent is universal basic income a sticking plaster. How are you going to, surely I think a better way, or rather when you're introducing universal basic income, you then need to think, well, in which case, if it's covering housing, how do we address the inequality in the housing market in Britain?
Yeah, I agree, but as I say, it's probably a debate for another time for certain, because we'd certainly go into that in some detail. But I mean, I'm broadly beginning to edge to be in favour of just giving everybody housing, whether it's micro housing, which is becoming being released in central London now, which is, they are tiny and they're not meant to raise a family and they're not for life. But £700 a month rent for what is a very good quality, I suppose you'd call it studio flat, but it's even a bit tidgier than that. But if it's 10 minutes from where you work, and if it's 5 minutes from Oxford Street where you want to be, you know, hanging out, then as a young person, you know, and also £700 a month with London salaries, you'd be able to save up for a mortgage at the same time.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
And it's a discussion for another day, though, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, then, if you're then thinking about doing that, you're then opening the can of worms as to what extent is the UK economy based upon the game of the housing market. Which then means, how else do we raise money in Britain? What is our economy based on? Which then brings us back to the idea of industry, which then brings us back to the idea of wages and universal basic income.
Social media can prove very entertaining, but also a minefield for the unwary. How do footballers get on Twitter? That's next after Beck. Apple flower dog, or will the batteries burst? And I'm out in the city, and the typical noise in the sun, tan lips and the filigree of energy. What you want, what you need. I'm down on my knees, in a pocket full of widows. You can do it down here, but you never did there. You feel untapped from the broken linear. Don't tell nobody I'm here. Don't tell nobody.
Shoot for the empire, land in the dust pile. I wanna wake up in the shadow of a fever pitch with the gold glass heart sending messages. I hear a voice on the phone, she pauses and says, they'll never, never, never go. Oh, can I stay here with you? Oh, there might be something better. You can change your mind, but you can't forget her.
So let it rise, the highest tide, satellite sky. Seventh heaven, so let it ride, ride, ride. The highest tide, the satellite sky. And I'm starting to fall in the seventh heaven. Now I'm starting to fall in the seventh heaven. Now you gotta let me know, gotta let me know. Now you gotta let me know, gotta let me know.
The album that track is from flew into the album chart at number 5 last week, only to tumble down to number 48 this week, which probably signifies that Beck continues to have a very loyal fan base who pick up on a new album right away. But like his older counterpart, Todd Rundgren, he then doesn't maintain an ongoing presence in the mainstream. That was from his excellent new album, Colours. That's Beck and Seventh Heaven.
Yeah, that's a really good comparison, actually. I'd never thought of Beck as being Todd Rundgren-like. But, you know, he does come out with some belters, doesn't he? And then he pops off and does a couple of weird albums for a bit. And then he comes back and produces another cracker. I haven't heard this album, Colours, in detail yet. But
it's mainstream. It's poppy, yes, mainstream. It's good.
It's got very good notices, yeah. So I'd be interested to see.
Now, footballers and social media, a volatile mix. Some take to it with skill, humour and a thick skin. Gary Lineker is followed on Twitter by 6.7 million people who enjoy his intelligent thoughts on all sorts of issues, not just sport. He's become, through Twitter, a very visible advocate for many causes, not least the plight
absolutely.
Of refugees throughout the world.
Yes, it's hilarious. And actually, funnily enough, when Jeremy Corbyn was going through a particularly troubled period prior to the general election and prior to the election being called, at one point, Gary Lineker was known on Twitter as being the real leader of the opposition.
Absolutely. Now, on the other hand, some footballers at all levels of the game have found that blurting out a couple of sentences in anger or ill attempts at humour have cost them dear, both financially from FA or club fines, but also in terms of reputation. However, Jules, you've discovered a top former international goalkeeper who seems to have linked his support for the previously mentioned Jeremy Corbyn with wide-ranging philosophical views on the challenges of modern life.
Yes, and who would have seen this coming, frankly? So Neville Southall, former Everton goalkeeper, former Wales goalkeeper, I believe. And also, I've always had a fondness for Neville Southall because he managed Hastings United, my hometown team, for a while, and actually did really rather well and was very well thought of generally. Fell out with the owners eventually and then left. And then eventually the owners themselves were forced out because people were so cross about it. But I remember a very happy day where he saved a penalty. And the place exploded to the point where I actually thought the chap next to me had died on the spot and didn't, unfortunately. He was one of ours for a bit, so we're all big fans of Neville from that point of view. But yes, he's been tweeting a lot recently. And he seems to have a lot of thoughts on different things. And particularly, he teaches now, apparently, or works in the education system. And he has a lot of thoughts. He first came to my attention because he was having a conversation with somebody about sort of trans rights and cisgender, and he very politely asked one of the female writers what cisgender meant, and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know," and came across as somebody that was genuinely willing to kind of learn. And then he started to have conversations with different feminists that had different types of views, and he just came across as someone that was very likable. And of course, he is, as you say, fiercely anti-conservative, and he's you know, tweeting a lot about the way that public sector workers are viewed and are paid. he comes across as being very entertaining and very kind of very, but he says it like it is. You always get a bit concerned with footballers that they get a bit, or particularly, or any kind of public sort of unexpected Twitter or social media sensation, that they then become, like my dad always says, is the curse of any public figure, is that you then start believing in your own publicity, and that is where, you know, sort of downfall lies. And I am a bit worried. His tweets have very much increased in frequency, and I am worried that Neville is approaching critical velocity and that we might then have a problem as a result of that. But no, I'm very much enjoying Neville's tweets, because they do actually, although they border on rants sometimes, they do have some level of political understanding and political argument. And for me, as someone that likes football and politics, albeit not in a kind of centrist dad type way, but you know what I mean. I'm kind of into that sort of thing. I feel the same way about football as I do about TV, which is that I do think there is more of an intellectual value to it, and it is often dismissed by people that just simply haven't bothered to understand it. Not everybody has to like everything, but I hate it when people dismiss stuff that they don't know anything about. I think that's really irritating. So I like the idea that Neville is proving that not all footballers are stupid. They can come across as quite... I mean, for example, my opinion of Wayne Rooney hugely increased after having followed him on Twitter. He then not only didn't deny the fact he was having a hair transplant, but live tweeted it using the hashtag #HairWeGo and various pictures of it being. And I thought that was so lovely that he was so secure in himself that he was willing just to sort of talk about it with his followers. You do get an insight into sort of footballers that would otherwise be quite distant. I guess the difference in Neville Southall is he's been long retired, so I suppose he's not really a footballer anymore, he's more of a person. But no, I am all for Neville Southall's rants on Twitter. I am a big fan.
I think most current footballers fall into two groups. The first, and by far the bigger, is that of players who are clearly receiving prompts from their sponsor or agents as they tweet the joys of some betting company or sports drink. And this group also they also tweet the bland self-motivational nonsense, such as after dismally losing to Crystal Palace, tweeting something like, "Disappointing result for us today. Thanks for your great support. We go again."
Or quoting Nelson Mandela when you draw with Stoke or something. Yes. Yeah.
You can tell that this has been honed by their club social media person. At my club, Chelsea, we have many of the "We go again, Viva Nelson Mandela" tweeting players, but we also have a couple of renegade players who form a sort of second group who are able to think for themselves. Michy Batshuayi at Chelsea is a fine example. He often comments with humour. He crashed into a goalpost on Wednesday. I was there against Everton.
Oh, yes, I saw that. It looked horrendous.
It did. And he was trying to score against Everton. Many fans immediately afterwards, after the game, tweeted to him directly, concerned for his welfare. And really good-naturedly, he replied to a lot of people saying he was probably feeling a lot better than the goalpost, which was, I think, a quick off-the-mark kind of response. And our David Zappacosta, new signing this year, having been penalised by the referee for twice taking foul throw-ins on Wednesday, tweeted on the same evening, "Does anyone know a throw-in coach?" Which, again, it just shows that, you know, they're not taking themselves too seriously and everything. So I rather like that. So it's possible to survive on Twitter if you're a footballer, but I think it's just follow the same advice as all of us, really. Be funny or be serious, but don't lose your temper and don't say racist or hurtful stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
Simple,
yeah.
Simple, really. The challenges of recreating complicated recorded music into the live arena. We're on to that next. It's after the Rosillos.
Just a slow as everyone knows. What you selling? What you
They're one of my favourite bands of the sort of punk, post-punk era. I don't know whether they were or not, but they always looked like they were having a whale of a time, the Rosillos. Number 17 in the UK in 1978, the wonderful Rosillos, and Top of the Pops.
Great choice.
Apart from the obvious reason that they just got fed up with touring, one of the reasons the Beatles used to give in contemporary interviews in the late 60s for no longer appearing live was that largely from Sgt. Pepper onwards, they felt they couldn't reproduce or even do justice to a lot of the material they recorded, as it had become too complicated with the advent and the progress of multi-track recording. All became too complicated to put it all together in the live environment. And this has plagued several artists over the years. And it produces a real dilemma, I think, in that if an artist or a group relies too heavily then on pre-recorded music at a gig, then it's a short step to audiences feeling they've been cheated. One group that increasingly grow in stature is Public Service Broadcasting, and they produce music in the studio that uses samples and clips from films and various archive footage. So how do they manage to transfer such a dynamic to the live stage? Well, Jules, you went along to the Delawar Pavilion in Bexhill to find out.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to be honest and say I wasn't just dispatched on business with a podcast. I quite wanted to go anyway. But having said that, I remain a faithful reporter to you all. So I went, and there was a slight change in personnel with who I went with due to my friend and her young children. But I did go with someone else. Tickets to see them at the Delawar Pavilion. We were very lucky in that we stood near the front of the stage, which I think was quite important. And Public Service Broadcasting, for any listeners that sort of aren't familiar with them, when people ask me to describe what their sound is like, they don't really sound like anyone else very much, because what they do is they use old news reports and old news footage in their live show. So if you listen to one record, obviously you only hear the sort of the audio stuff, but they also use a lot of visuals live, and they have sort of what I could only describe as sort of themed albums, really. I don't want to use the phrase concept album, but they do. I mean, they've got an album that they had, they released an EP called The War Room with lots of war footage on it. They had one about space, The Race for Space, and they also, their most recent one, and I think I sort of referenced a little bit earlier, is called Every Valley, and it's about the rise and fall of coal mining in the South Welsh valleys from the 1950s to the 1980s. And I have to say, their live show is one of the most spectacular I've ever seen. The Delawar Pavilion is a capacity of about 1,500. It's a wonderful modernist venue that was made in 1935 and was first built in 1935. It says on all their branding, established 1935, modern ever since. And so it's quite an impressive sort of venue. But so we did see someone complaining on social media that the lighting wasn't, quote, gig lighting, which is the most unsound opinion I've seen in some years, frankly. So their stage set, there are broadly speaking four of them. It's always a good sign when one of the members of the band's sole responsibility is for visuals. So they had all these screens up that showed lots of footage of, for example, Welsh miners and sort of space footage and that sort of thing. And this chap was also roaming around the stage with a video camera. That's probably not the right phrase now, is it? But, you know, he was filming the other members performing, which was then fed into the sort of the video feed as well. And it was a phenomenal gig. It was extremely moving as well. And I'll talk about the last song in particular. But they had there was a huge mining wheel that had been erected on one side of the stage, and they had all these lamps, miners' lamps, that kept dropping down and lighting up from the ceiling, which was just incredible, really. And I think and the sound, actually, so where we were stood, the main kind of leader, they all go under pseudonym, so the main leader, who is called Wild Goose, I don't know what his real name is, does a lot of setting off pads and things, so sort of playing synthesized samples. Lots of the kind of the samples that are woven into their music, he sets off with a pad that's quite similar to what I use for radio, really. So you press buttons and they set things off. And actually, you think, oh god, how boring to but actually it was fascinating watching him do it, because he was playing guitar as well and obviously manipulating a lot of the sound. And they have a song called Public Service Broadcasting, which features those three words repeated, and at one point the button that had public on it did not go off when he pressed it. And it was actually quite interesting to see him kind of sort of sighing as it didn't go off and then moving on to something else. So it was fascinating to watch. It was, it really got me thinking, because lots of the footage that they were showing about the Welsh sort of miners, and actually it was relevant, like I say, to universal basic income and thinking about the dignity of work, and when that work goes, that's what leaves a kind of a hole in society, and those sort of Welsh mining communities have struggled to recover, and that was then one of the things that fed into Brexit and that sort of stuff. So they were very thought-provoking, but also a lot of fun. They had a horn section that popped on and off. Wow. And they were all dressed. They were all rather nerdy young men in those black glasses like the ones that I have. So I felt I was very much amongst my people. And these three guys, the horn section, came on and sort of, you know, gradually got more and more enthusiastic. And there was a particular large chap that was in wire rim glasses that was adept at whipping the crowd up. I think he was a saxophonist. And they finished, well, their encore, their last song was a song about Mount Everest. But before that, the song that everybody was shouting for that's perhaps their best known, we've played it on the podcast before. I know this because I looked it up to see if I could choose it this week, and we had it in 2015. It's called Gagarin.
Oh, I remember it. It's excellent.
And it is excellent. And the funny thing is, we said it just goes to show, it was packed. I don't think it was sold out, but it was pretty busy. And that was the song that everyone was shouting for. And I said to my friend I went with afterwards, I can't believe that we're all shouting for a song about a Russian astronaut. Mm-hmm. This is such a niche kind of thing, but it's rather a sort of funky song. And the horn section broke out into the most spectacular dancing that I think I've ever seen, to the point where the trombonist danced across the stage, appearing to ride his trombone as if it was a horse at one point. So it was, and then the support band, two members of the support band, ran on dressed as astronauts and started dancing with the horn section. So it was, I would thoroughly recommend going to see public service broadcasting, because their sound is very challenging in that they've got talented to put on. We were saying that they must have taken so long to set up compared to other sort of plug-in and play type bands. We had some sympathy for the support band Palace, who were rather sort of crammed into a small square of the stage playing amongst all of public service broadcasting's gear, because it was such an undertaking to set them up, mostly sort of setting off all the samples and the visual side of things. But the venue was more than equal to it, and I think it says a lot about the Dead of War Pavilion that they were able to put that on. I mean, they were playing, you know, they were playing quite big venues across the country, quite big London venues. They played Brixton before, for example, and I didn't feel that the size of the venue affected what was produced at all, and they managed to find a way of setting off all these kind of samples. And, you know, there was the bit where they had striking Welsh miners fighting with the police, and my friend pointed out that the music appeared to be pounding along in time to them running, which is really quite impressive. So I would recommend going to see public service broadcasting, because they have a very unique sound that they managed to produce live perfectly.
I remember reading a review this summer, which was otherwise positive, after they played at the Latitude Festival this summer, which said that because of the visuals, they're probably at their best in smaller venues like Delaware Pavilion. But I think, of course, that's all very well, but when you've got an increasing number of people wanting to see your group, it must be hard, if not impossible, to turn down the chance of appearing at the big arenas and festivals.
Yes, absolutely. And I should think that, you know, big arenas, the video screens can be enlarging, can't they, really? I think it's difficult when you're playing open air festivals, because your sound does get lost a lot anyway. So I don't know, maybe they are better with a roof, but I think that roof can be as big as it likes, frankly.
Are you transferring your studio sound to the live environment, or indeed vice versa, this week?
Ah, that is a perfect segue. Well done, Sir Terence. I will be on the radio on Wednesday evening on Barricade Radio doing Indie Wonderland from 8 until 10 p.m. I will also be in the live arena actually on Friday the 3rd of November. Myself and my friend that I attended the gig with, Letty Gallagher, we are Sheila's Take a Bow. We are a DJing duo, and we are also a promotions duo now, it would seem, as well. And we're putting on some bands in Hastings at a venue called The Palace, where I've DJed before. They're called the Atom Jacks of the support band, and then the Soap Opera are this sort of French indie boys that have come over, and they're doing some gigs in the UK. So if you like sort of indie type music, then I would thoroughly recommend that you come down and see the bands play, and also see us do some DJing as well. So that's on Friday the 3rd, and then the Saturday Social is back next weekend.
Excellent. Don't forget, if you would like to be made aware immediately when our next podcast comes out, the best thing to do is subscribe.
On iTunes or your podcast subscription choice. choice. And if you do subscribe on iTunes, if you would be kind enough to write us a review, then that way it makes it much easier for other people to find us.
Always worth listening to, whether pre-recorded or live. That's our executive producer, Rona. Many thanks
yes,
to her.
Yes, absolutely. I'm always a keen consumer of her hashtag content.
And we stay with public service broadcasting as our last offering today, Jules.
Yes, and why not? And actually, I'd mentioned this earlier, this was one of the more moving songs. I mean, the Welsh Valley stuff is really moving, I think. And this is a song about the idea of the emancipation of women and how women's voices were increased by coal mining and how they then started to find their own place in society. And I think this is terrific. And actually, visually, when this was on and you saw the footage of women talking and you heard the audio of women talking and the stage went dark and all these lamps dropped down from the ceiling suspended on wires, it was impossibly moving. And particularly the woman at the end of this track, I just think this is desperately inspiring, and it was a privilege to see it. So this is public service broadcasting, and from the album Every Valley, this is called They Gave Me a Lamp.
If you could get the women to one meeting or get them involved in one thing, they could see there was this other life. And then they started questioning other aspects of their life, not just relating to themselves. Or like myself, politics was just something that didn't affect me, but politics is life. And everything to do with it affects you, directly or indirectly. They weren't taught to wire a plug, they were taught to make a sponge. They weren't taught how to change a wheel on a car. They were taught the proper way to iron a white shirt. You can't climb up the street, you're a girl. You can't come with us because you're a girl. And it made me damn determined to do it. And I suppose it sort of stuck with me. So I didn't see any reason why I shouldn't be out there doing what I was doing. Why I shouldn't go pick a day, why I shouldn't be in the support group. I think a lot of women found their feet.
Sat back, and I have never refused anybody, and I am very proud of it, and I'll be proud to look back on it.
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.